We're talking farm to plate, and we're joined now by a very famous farmer. I don't know whether you call you the most famous farmer in the world, the most influential, but certainly Time magazine has said that Joel Salatin is someone in farming that we should be listening to, and you can listen to him here on the Country Hour. Thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thank you. It's my privilege to be here.
And I guess the theme here today about local and global, this is something you've been preaching for some time.
Well, it is, and I'm certainly not opposed to global. I mean, global's here, and we and every place can't produce the same thing all the time. But I'm a big fan of trying to shorten that chain of custody between the farmer and the plate, to shorten warehouse, loss, spoilage, maintain freshness, you know, all those, and maintain transparency so a customer, so there's more accountability in the food system.
Accountability and also regenerative agriculture is something that's really taking off here in Australia. In Virginia, obviously, that's something that you've been cognizant of for some time too, even though you get more rainfall than most of Australia. But, you know, you've got to look after your soil, the water.
Absolutely. Well, all those climatic conditions are pretty, pretty customized. I mean, for us, if it doesn't rain for 2 months, that's equivalent to, you know, the outback not getting rain for whatever, 2 years, right? So it does become relative. But yeah, we are all about regenerating the soil, hydrating the landscape, making cleaner air, sequestering carbon, you know, all those kinds of things.
And is that why you think regenerative agriculture, that sort of topic, is really taking off, but not just in the United States, but it seems to be taking off here in Australia and in a drought year as well in New South Wales?
Well, certainly, and worldwide. I mean, I'm just here. I've just finished doing workshops in Germany, France, and Spain. So I'm on a worldwide tour, and the whole, you know, question of how do we keep feeding ourselves, soil depletion, potable water, available potable water, you know, those are topics that are on the minds of a lot of people other than farmers, and it's time.
But I guess when you talk about, Australia is an export nation, so we still need to be looking beyond the local to export,
sure.
And you can still do that and look after things in your own backyard as well?
Yes, absolutely, and I think it's important for people to appreciate that this exchange here in Kingscliff is not indicting exports at all. What it is suggesting is that there's an opportunity here to capitalize on agritourism and the food scene, chefing, to wrap these all up in a package that makes destination places for people to come and increases the whole economic pool that's coming into agriculture. That's an important theme.
But a lot of people believe that in order to get the sort of scale of production, you need to look at industrial agriculture, you need to look at chemicals, you need companies like Monsanto, you need fertilizer, you need the big machinery. You've got some concerns about that model.
Well, I do, and again, scale is not just because we're here focusing on local provenance in the food system does not mean anybody here is opposed to exports. I'm certainly not opposed to exports. We don't grow bananas in Virginia, so I'm glad somebody's exporting bananas. But that's a separate issue than can we actually grow the food. Export is one thing and production is another. And for sure, we can, using holistic management, using other systems, you know, without chemicals, without GMO, genetically modified organisms, without those things, we can absolutely feed the world on our farm. We stack, you know, we have cattle, chickens, pigs, turkeys, rabbits, ducks, and you stack these on the landscape, so you're not just using a monospecies, you're using multiple species across the landscape. It makes a big difference in production.
Now, Joel, this is your 16th trip to Australia, which is astonishing. Many of the speakers here at the Farm to Plate Exchange, you know, mention you as a major influence on their decision to adopt these farming systems. Do you feel like you've, you know, changed the Australian farming landscape in some aspect?
Well, you know, I do, and it's great to come here now and see people that one farmer came up to me. She said, "This is the sixth time I've heard you." It's really gratifying to come and see people that I met back in the early visits to Australia, 15 years ago, and realize, wow, they took some of these principles, they adapted them to Australia, not only to the climate, but to the economy, the community here, and were able to, tease out the principles are the same, but they have to be locally adapted. And it's really exciting to see people take those, run with them, and they're full-time farming. Very, very gratifying.
Quite often you do hear people talk about, the systems that you talk about, that sort of multi-layered one being more suitable where you've got higher rainfall sort of areas. Although we do hear some people, some graziers, that have tried to adopt some of those ideas onto the drier landscape, and it can work.
Absolutely, it can work. I think the biggest issue is how far are you away from markets. I mean, that gets a little bit touchy. But look, I always suggest any naysayer can come up and present the most extreme situation and say, solve that for me. It's like a little bit of a dig. Here's the most extreme situation, solve this for me. Well, I can't just stand here and solve every situation. What I can say is that if everybody who could would, that the farmscape, the foodscape would change so dramatically that the folks for whom it is harder, who now currently live on the extremes, like in the outback and drier areas, that if the foodscape changed enough because people who could access and do these things would, the foodscape would change so much that we don't even really know, I think, what would come out the other end. It's like any innovation, things happen, you can't really prepare for all the ramifications of innovation.
Yeah, one of your quotes which grabbed me in your session this morning, when you said that you thought it was atrocious that people have to work in town to fund their farming addiction, and I'm sure that really rings true for a lot of our listeners.
Well, absolutely. And so we're all, I say, look, if you want to farm, let's farm. Let's figure out how to do this. And so part of my message is how to leverage the resources we have on a farm, not exploit them, but leverage them so that even while we're ramping up the income on the farm, we're not depleting the soil, the air, the water, the commons. And we're actually increasing all those while we're teasing out more income. That usually means it's going to be a couple more enterprises. There are going to be some very complex relationships, which sounds a lot like ecology. And the goal is to actually to appreciate. I haven't been I visit thousands of farms around the world, including my own, and I don't think there's a farm in the world that is fully leveraging its resource base. You can always add something else. That doesn't mean you have to work another 10 hours a week. What it does mean is often that you collaborate with other partners, other team members, neighbors, different people, to actually tease out more income from that that piece of property.
And that's one of the key messages here at Farm to Plate Exchange this week.
And it shouldn't, be a case where you have to have a teacher or a nurse or someone working for a chemical company just to keep the farm ticking over, just to get enough money in the bank.
Right. Every time somebody presents kind of a what about if I'm a real small farm or things like that, then the next thing you see is somebody come in with a one hectare farm, and they're generating $400,000 off a one hectare farm using real intensive mescaline mix and things like that. Now, if everybody did that, would that market exist? Well, of course not. To answer the question for every single person, because everybody's not going to do it anyway. And the thing that I promote is you don't have to answer it for every other person. You just have to answer it for you. And if you can do it and it works for you, that's all that matters right now.
And I guess the last question I wanted to ask you was about the Monsanto court case. Another court case, $2 billion for two people that caught the same sort of cancer from using it. It's not the only case. There's another case, and there's a whole bunch of other cases.
Oh, there's.
And I guess you're not surprised what you've been talking about in terms of chemical use in various forms, not just glyphosate.
Yeah, no, I think there's about 11,400 pending. We're in the early days of this, but I can tell you in the U.S., a lot of people that I respect are kind of on the verge of saying this may be another tobacco deal. You know, where the tobacco companies really took it on the chin and almost destroyed the tobacco industry. And it could be that this may be one of the worst acquisitions Bayer ever made.
Because they just bought the company. So, yeah, it's like buying the farm. Just bought the company. Yeah,
they sure did.
Okay, Joel, thanks for your time on the program today. Appreciate it.
Thanks
and enjoy
for
your trip. I gather you're going to Victoria next. So
I'm actually going to Perth next.
Right.
And then I go to Victoria.
Right, yeah. Okay. So you're a busy man.
Yes.
All right, thanks for your time on the program today. Appreciate it.